Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing possibility that the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation into the Trump campaign's alleged ties to Russia may not produce the smoking gun revelation that some hope could be grounds for the impeachment and removal of Donald Trump. Ali Watkins, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security for BuzzFeed News, joins us to discuss her latest article at BuzzFeed News, Inside the Senate's Russia Investigation. We'll look into whether, by focusing on the Trump campaign's Russia-connected bottom feeders like Paul Manafort and Carter Page, the press and partisan Democrats have lost sight of the original charges of Russian interference that came in a consensus from the intelligence community that Russia meddled in our elections and that orders to do so came from Putin. And if it turns out that Trump is exonerated, the earlier findings by the U.S. intelligence community will be all but forgotten. Then we will speak with Robert Stavins, a professor and director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School, who was a lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He joins us to discuss the remarks by the new head of the EPA on CNBC, where Scott Pruitt stated that, quote, "I would not agree that human activity is a primary contributor to the global warming we see." We will examine the likelihood that Pruitt will escalate from global warming denial to global warming cover-up, and that he will act on his belief that the U.S. should pull out of the International Paris Climate Agreement. Then finally, we will look into the Trump administration's latest travel ban, otherwise known as a Muslim ban, which already the states of Hawaii, Washington, New York, and Massachusetts are challenging in court, and speak with Christine Fair, a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program, who is a specialist on South Asia security issues. She joins us to discuss the reaction to the latest Muslim ban in Muslim countries and how the Republicans are complicit in covering up Trump's misogyny, to the point that the GOP should be called the Grab Our Pussy Party. And joining us now is Ali Watkins, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News and previously covered national security for the McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau. Her latest article at BuzzFeed News is Inside the Senate's Russia Investigation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Watkins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks, Ali. And last time we spoke, you were sort of standing outside the door of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, where inside, of course, they're all insulated against spying in their bubble. And you were having to kind of read the tea leaves on the faces as they came out of the briefings. But now I take it you've got a few people, even though they've maintained their anonymity, to go on the record. And at this point, it's beginning to look like there may be no there or no great smoking gun in terms of the Russian connections to the Trump campaign, notwithstanding the earlier statements by the consensus of the Intelligence Committee that the Russians did meddle in our elections and this strategy was directed by Putin himself. So let's start with that context. Is this what you're telling us now from what you're learning is that there may not be any great smoking gun in terms of the collusion between the campaign and the Russians, but how does that fit into the overall opinion that came down from the consensus of the U.S. intelligence community?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really interesting dynamic happening now on the Intelligence Committee. Obviously, they're kind of taking their investigation a day at a time. And the point we're kind of to right now is there's two real narratives at play. One is the known and widely agreed upon fact that the Kremlin directed a covert intelligence operation to influence the U.S. election. And the other part of this narrative is whether there was collusion between Trump or Trump's associates and Russian intelligence operatives. And part of what the story is about and a lot of the frenzy going on in Washington right now is everybody is kind of focused on these contacts between Trump associates and, for example, Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak or other, you know, Russian oligarchs, whatever. But there's a concern in Washington that the evidence to support those suspicions are not there, that particularly the Senate investigation is not going to find anything that could lead to either Trump's impeachment or the prosecution of his associates, and that by focusing so much on that side of the narrative, the bigger picture and the known fact of the Russian intelligence operation, the broader effort to influence the election, is getting lost. So I think that that's becoming a growing concern as these investigations continue to get underway, is that there's kind of a missing the forest for the trees phenomenon happening.
But is that to say, though, is that a general feeling that you're getting from the members of the committees that you spoke to? Because they're not all completely pessimistic about this smoking gun eventually emerging. I noticed that that Mark Warner and Senator Burr, the Republican chair, went over to the CIA, I think it was yesterday or the day before yesterday, and were given raw intelligence. I don't know whether that made any difference, but is it still pretty much along partisan lines where the Republicans, you know, sort of don't want to know, and the Democrats are looking for something, even if it's not there?
That's kind of the most interesting thing to me that's emerged in the last week, is that I think Democrats are realizing that there may not be that tangible. And to underscore here what you said, this is not universally held. There are a lot of Democrats there who still think that there's room to find clear evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. But the people who are actually reviewing the intelligence, the people who are really down in the weeds on this issue, are saying that, you know, the story isn't really whether there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. And I want to try and kind of clarify, this is obviously really complicated, but it's not really a matter of there not being a there. I think there's a concern that people are focusing on the wrong there. If that makes sense, it's a lot of theirs. But people are getting so obsessed with the Trump-Russia connection that they're missing this bigger issue of the Russians influencing the election. And that, you know, short of finding something that clearly links the Trump campaign to Russia, people are going to forget about this known fact that, you know, just the baseline fact that Russian intelligence operatives waged a covert campaign and to a degree succeeded in influencing the U.S. election. That alone is a massive and very grave conclusion. So I think there's a concern that the Trump-Russia connection is kind of the shiny object of the moment. And there's a real concern on a bipartisan basis from Democrats and Republicans that the known narrative of Russian intelligence operatives attempting to influence Western elections, there's a concern that that's going to get lost.
So does this mean in a way that the Democrats and, you know, the so-called liberal press, if you will, set themselves up here by raising expectations that there would be a connection exposed between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin? And in effect, as you just pointed out, there are still some incredibly bad things that happened out there that haven't been investigated. But unless you come up with that specific smoking gun, Trump's going to, you know, basically get a pass. And he's going to say, look, I told you so, and it'll all be forgotten.
Yeah, I think that is right there is exactly the concern. And there is, I think, I don't know where the blame necessarily lies, but there has, I think, indisputably been an absolute frenzy, particularly in Washington, about anything relating to Trump and Russia. I mean, we saw last week to a point where anyone connected to Trump who even said hello to the Russian ambassador was somehow getting a headline in a major news outlet. So, I mean, there is kind of this hysteria right now of kind of anything related that touches Trump and Russia is now under scrutiny, even if it's something completely normal. I mean, of course ambassadors make the circuit on the campaign. Of course ambassadors show up to political conventions. But there is this kind of hysteria right now with the Trump-Russia connection, and it is kind of eclipsing the known issue.
Right, but that's not to say that it appears that Trump has built a firewall in the sense that he's got Sessions at the DOJ. He's got Pompeo, a political appointee, at the CIA. He's got Coates, who's going to be the DNI. He's got Burr, who was on his campaign as the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and Devin Nunes, who was also on his campaign, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. And Nunes has made it clear that he's absolutely rabidly partisan in protecting Trump. So, I mean, that is the objective reality, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a very obvious buffer between Trump and pretty much anybody who has the ability to be critical of him. And frankly, I mean, when you look at, you know, the CIA has a certain amount of jurisdiction to handle this, but for the most part, they kind of retreat into their own dark hole. The DOJ would be the most realistic agency to deal with any potentially legally prosecutable thing. But as you mentioned, you have Sessions in charge of that. Though he has, you know, worth noting, recused himself from Russia-related investigations. But I think a lot of people's expectations right now are hedged on Congress. And you certainly correctly observed that the House side, led by Devin Nunes, has made clear that they are about as partisan as you can possibly get. So much of, I think, that weight and the expectation is falling on the Senate and the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation, which has its own limited jurisdiction, but they are getting a lot of access to raw intelligence. And what they find, I think, is going to be held up as probably the authoritative source on the Trump-Russia question.
Well, it's interesting, though, that it's, you know, all what happened with Flynn, et cetera, obviously has changed things. And now with McMaster in there, I don't know whether he's brought in Fiona Hill, but she's somebody I've known for years, and she's really very, very good, very knowledgeable about Russia. So the fact that she's in there doesn't look like, you know, that's a continuation of some kind of nefarious covert relationship that Trump has. And the Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen has a very skeptical piece at the New York Review of Books titled Russia, the Conspiracy Trap, where she thinks that these allegations will not bring Trump down, but meanwhile, they serve as a huge distraction while Trump continues to wage war on immigrants, cuts funding for everything that's not military, assembling a cabinet of what she calls deplorables, et cetera, et cetera. So do you think that when you said we're missing the forest for the trees, is that a real paradox here, that maybe by pursuing this particular narrow angle of the Russian connection, the press is not focusing on the daily activities of the Trump administration?
Absolutely. The Gessen piece, I think, did a really good job of really laying out a lot of the pitfalls in the current media environment on the Trump-Russia question. Granted, you know, there are a lot of reporters doing really good work on Trump's daily happenings, but the Russia thing is kind of the elephant in the room, right? And there is, I think there's, again, this is certainly not universally held, but I think Gessen is correct in that this is not the issue that's going to bring down Trump. And I think that some Democrats, even Democrats who once thought it might bring down Trump, are now kind of seeing that, like, you know, maybe we're not going to, I mean, the bar to impeach a president is very high, you know, and the notion that Trump is a covert Russian intelligence agent, you know, you mentioned appointing Fiona Hill. I think there, it's a very easily stated fact. Like, if Trump were a covert Russian operative, he would have been handling his first 3 months much differently. You know, he would have been doing a lot more to kind of grease the skids as far as the U.S. and Moscow. And I think Gessen also makes the very smart point in her story. She's obviously much more familiar with Russian politics than I. But just so much of the reporting on Trump and Russia right now misses a lot of the nuance about Russian security services generally. I mean, it's a world of gray zones. We're not talking about a question of is Trump or isn't he, or are Trump's associates in connection with Russian intelligence operatives or aren't they? It's not a yes or no thing. The world of Russian security services is far more gray than what we can really comprehend from an Americanized perspective. So there is this weird phenomenon happening in media right now where we're looking at this as a very black and white story of like, well, Trump either was a Russian agent and the Russian operation was a big deal, or he's not and it wasn't. And the truth lies very much in the middle of those two things.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Ali Watkins, I've always wondered about these kind of bottom feeders that they've been focusing on, Manafort, Carter Page. I mean, they don't seem like serious people. I've never seen the lawyer, but he's Trump's lawyer is also involved. It seems really like amateur land. If the Russians were operating as an intelligence operation, they'd have much, much more skillful people, I think. But just in closing, though, the British former MI6 spy, his report, so there have been reports that a lot of what was in his report is being verified, not the more salacious stuff, but other stuff. And he's still out there. So is it still possible that more of his dossier will be proven correct?
You know, Ian, every prediction I have made for the last year has been proven wrong. So there is always a possibility for everything. If the last year has taught me anything, it is that there are certainly still possibilities. And there's a lot we don't know. You know, we're in the very early stages of these investigations. The last 6 months were kind of a whirlwind on this subject. So there's room for anything to happen at this point.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ali Watkins.
Thanks a lot for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Watkins, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News and previously covered national security for the McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau. Her latest article at BuzzFeed News is Inside the Senate's Russia Investigation. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the new head of the EPA could move from climate change denial to a cover-up. You can't hide. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Stavins, a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School, and a lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Stavins.
Good to be with you again, Ian.
Well, thank you, Robert. And what did you make of the new head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt's remarks that clearly indicate, not that it was a great secret, but that he is a dyed-in-the-wool, if you will, climate change denier?
Well, you know, given his history of having played a lead role in a series of lawsuits by states' attorneys general to try to stop the Clean Power Plan and roll back other climate regulations, it shouldn't be a surprise. One should note, however, it is a departure from the substantially more moderate tone and language that he adopted during his confirmation hearings.
So he is obviously, you know, as I say, showing his true colors. And is that a better thing, in other words, that he, I mean, it's pretty cynical, isn't it, that you essentially either so much perhaps lie or at least aren't entirely honest with the Senate. And that's happened with a lot of the candidates, frankly. I could go through the whole list of almost everybody that's been approved, and quite often with votes from Democrats. You know, Mnuchin was less than forthcoming. Betsy DeVos was less than forthcoming. So was Pruitt, of course. So is it better, in effect, that now there are no illusions about who this guy is?
Well, it was always expected, and from announcements we'd already heard from the Oval Office, it was clear that the Clean Power Plan would be rolled back, which is essentially easier said than done, and that other regulations are going in similar direction, including, importantly, the corporate average fuel economy standards that affect motor vehicle fuel efficiency.
So is there yet another shoe that could drop in terms of the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Accords?
Well, that's the big remaining question. I mean, I would have been shocked to hear myself say this 5 months ago, but the bright light and source for conditional optimism in the Trump administration with regards to climate change policy is the former CEO of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, now the U.S. Secretary of State, because Exxon, under his leadership, ExxonMobil had gone from being an activist climate skeptic to being a company that had officially endorsed a carbon tax when and if there is a meaningful climate policy in the United States, and also was very supportive of the Paris Agreement, and he was himself. And then famously during his confirmation hearings, he said that we're better off being at the table. So it does appear at this point in time that he is the remaining hope, together apparently with the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump.
Who used to date Leo DiCaprio, who was active in terms of the environmental movement and raising awareness about the dangers of climate change and global warming. So what's happening, though, in terms of stacking the EPA? My understanding is that Pruitt is bringing in a whole bunch of people as deputies who are like-minded, most of whom come from the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, I mean, this in and of itself is not terribly unusual, that when a political party comes in, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, then they bring in the people, sometimes from state government, sometimes from think tanks, and sometimes from lobbyists from the private sector, or in the case of Democrats, environmental NGOs. They bring in the people that are supportive of the positions they want to take. And that's happening in the case of this administration as well. What's really striking is that it's not a slight departure or moderate departure, which is what we saw the back and forth between George H.W. Bush administration to Clinton administration, and that we saw then with the George W. Bush administration, and then to Obama. But this is really a radical change. It's hard for me to picture a change of administrations on environment and many other issues, for that matter, that has ever been as dramatic as the one from Obama to Trump.
So at this point, the EPA's climate change website states the following: recent climate changes, however, cannot be explained by natural causes alone. Research indicates that natural causes do not explain most observed warming, especially warming since the mid-20th century. Rather, it is extremely likely that human activities have been the dominant cause of that warming. So that is definitely not what Scott Pruitt said on CNBC. So is there any vestiges of reality in the EPA, or has the purge not been complete?
Oh, I assume that we're going to see changes in the web pages going forward. If the opinions of the administrator are, to some degree, really the official opinions, the opinions that matter in terms of affecting policy of the agency. That said, the people that are the civil servants that are not a political appointees that stay from one administration to another at EPA, the scientists, the lawyers, the engineers, the economists, their views are not going to be changed as a result of the change in the political leadership.
So back to Tillerson, and it is odd that Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of Exxon, should be our best hope for some reality about what's happening to the planet and what's causing it here, and arguably it's the most important issue that mankind faces. So Pruitt has dismissed the Paris Climate Agreement. He said it was a bad deal. And he said, but when you front-load your costs, as we endeavor to do in this agreement, and then China and India backload their costs for 2030 and beyond, that's not good for America. That's not an American type of approach. What do you think, short of pulling out, could they do? Or is it in any way it's binding, isn't it?
Well, so what's binding with the Paris Agreement is simply that each party, which is a country or the European Union, that each party periodically states what it anticipates it can do. But whatever it actually says it can do, in the case of the United States, it's a 26 to 28% reduction by 2025 relative to 2005. That was the nationally determined contribution of the Obama administration. Those numbers themselves are not binding under international law. All that's binding is that you have to make this statement and then renew it periodically and then provide evidence of whether or not you're achieving it. So they don't need to pull out of the Paris Agreement. For that matter, I suspect that if they don't pull out of the Paris Agreement, the people who run it, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, will be so happy that the U.S. is staying in that my guess is they would not object to the Trump administration modifying that, you know, that pledge to keep it in line with what they think they're really going to be able to achieve, since the Clean Power Plan of the Obama administration apparently is going to be gone.
So if Tillerson has a little bit of wiggle room there, in general, though, one questions the extent to which he can endure more humiliation, because he's really been sort of sidelined, it seems. The idea that you're going to, in order to raise an extra $54 billion for defense, you're going to cut the $50 billion State Department budget, and the EPA budget, which is only $8 billion. None of the math makes any sense. You'd have to entirely cut State Department's the entire budget minus $4 billion. So what do you think is going on there? And I notice when there are photo ops at the State Department now with the, you know, world leaders that visit, normally the press asks questions, but absolutely tight-lipped. Tillerson never answers the questions. And Andrea Mitchell of NBC News has basically said the other day, you know, how much humiliation can you take? You know, he's going to cut all your budget. Is there no money for diplomacy left? Is diplomacy no longer a priority? Of course, he stays stone-faced. But what do you think's going on with him?
Well, I think that, you know, Mr. Tillerson, who was a respected and very effective CEO of his company with tremendous experience, obviously, in the oil industry over a very long time, didn't have any experience in government. Now, the size of the company he was running was larger than, you know, some small countries in the world, but nevertheless, he didn't have experience in government. And what he is going to need to do as Secretary of State is to pick and choose his fights. To me, one of the big questions is whether or not climate change would be something in which he would want to invest the relatively small amount of political capital, as you've illustrated, that he apparently has. My guess is, sadly, that it's not, because he's got a number of other issues. You know, the U.S. Position vis-a-vis European countries with regards to NATO, the Middle East, refugee issues. There are Korea, China. There are many issues he has to deal with that are really going to be on the first order of concern for the State Department. So in terms of climate change, if he does decide to exercise some political capital on that, then the way I picture it is a boxing ring set up inside the Oval Office. And on one side is Rex Tillerson, and maybe wiping his brow is Ivanka Trump. And on the other side is Stephen Bannon. And again, sad to say, I think Mr. Bannon would just demolish Mr. Tillerson in that ring. So that's why, although I would say that the greatest hope is really Rex Tillerson being at the State Department in terms of climate change, I'm not very optimistic.
So what then, Robert Stavis, do you think makes Stephen Bannon tick in terms of what is the basis of his objections? Is it because liberals like climate change? Because Breitbart seems to be entirely framed around a kind of petulant hatred of anything that is liberal and progressive. It's almost, you know, a sort of reflex as opposed to any kind of intellectual gravity.
Well, you know, I couldn't even begin to guess what makes Mr. Bannon tick, But an important question that you're raising is, why is it that the right, not just Republicans, but also the extreme right, are so opposed to climate change action and, indeed, in many cases, are skeptical of climate as a problem? That's something that is unique in the United States. I spend a lot of time in Europe and Asia, other parts of the world, and even in those areas where there's concern or an opposition to taking action on climate change policy because of the costs that are going to be involved, it's still generally recognized by all the participating core political parties that it's a real problem. Some people would say, I don't know if this is valid, is that one of the things that made this such a negative cause for the right was the fact that Al Gore, in their mind, politicized the problem, that it went from being a scientific issue to a great political issue because of Al Gore's, you know, leadership. And whether or not that was an important factor, I don't know. But the reality is what you said. The United States stands out as a place where one of our major political parties, and certainly the fringes as well, voiced tremendous skepticism about the science.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Robert Stavins, what do environmentalists do when you've got this, you know, Dracula in charge of the blood bank, this in-your-face kind of insult to anybody that cares about the environment and about the fate of the planet? By putting this man in there, that's, you know, a pretty brazen insult. So, you know, rather than sort of whine from the sidelines, what do we do?
Well, I think that there are two things. One is what to think about, and the other is how to take action. In terms of what to think about, frankly, I think that what people have to watch for are going to be the ongoing investigations regarding the links between the Trump campaign and Russia. That's going to be paramount in terms of the future of this administration, at least of this presidency. Even if this presidency, however, were to end prematurely as a result of that, a Pence administration would not be significantly different in terms of climate change policy, although it certainly would be in tone and in strategy. In the short term, and perhaps throughout the 4 years, I think what people need to give attention to, and in California, you're in fortune in this way, is to state-level policy. So California is in the forefront with AB 32, in particular the cap-and-trade system. The governor now is enthusiastic, Governor Brown, about extending that beyond 2020, looking to 2030 and beyond. That's exceptionally important. California is playing a leadership role. Oregon and Washington are coming along also with significant climate policies. And then in the Northeast, the area encompassed by the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, the New England and North Atlantic states with New York are taking action. So essentially, if you want to, you know, if you look at a recent election, it's the blue states, basically, are where there is action. But in a much larger set of states, about 50% of the states, so a lot of red states, there are renewable energy programs of various kinds. And in bipartisan fashion, quite remarkably, in December of 2015, the Congress, at a moment of bipartisanship, extended the tax credits, the subsidies, essentially, on wind and solar power. And those are broadly supported by both parties, since elected officials like to give out benefits, not costs. So there are ways in which there will continue to be progress, but I think in order to see that progress, you have to think of the United States geographically, not as defined by the federal government.
Thanks again, Robert Stavins, for joining us here in the California Republic.
My pleasure to be with you.
Again, I've been talking with Robert Stavins, a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School and a lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We can take a brief station break and back looking into whether the GOP should be called the Grab Our Pussy Party.
When I get home to that red land, and I wanna shout down Satan's story in concert with the bloodwash band. But I'm only going over Jordan.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program, who specializes in South Asian security issues. She's a member of Women in International Security and the American Institute of Pakistan Studies, and her latest book is Fighting to the End, the Pakistan Army's Way of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, thanks, Christine. I want to catch up on a few things. First of all, the fact that you spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, where you were a former United Nations political officer. A couple of your friends, one was murdered, I think, at the behest of the Pakistan Intelligence, the ISI, in Kabul, a journalist. And now,
we were all election monitors. It was
She was also election monitor, was she?
And it was a he.
A he.
Yeah.
And then just yesterday, there was this horrible attack on a hospital in Kabul, apparently conducted by Islamic State fighters dressed as medical personnel, as doctors. Do you know the hospital? And it certainly raises questions about whether that place will ever be stable.
So, I mean, speaking to Afghanistan, I mean, the problem, and boy, you and I have talked about this so much on this show. Is that, you know, the biggest problem has been, for the majority of the period that we've been fighting in Afghanistan, is that Pakistan has been absolutely wedded to helping the Taliban win, even while we're paying them. And so, you know, essentially, Americans should know that really since, we can say for certain, about 2004 onward, possibly earlier, that the Pakistanis were taking our money, giving them to the Taliban, and killing our troops. At the same time, Pakistan's own militant groups began mobilizing against the state, and we began seeing the movement develop of what would eventually coalesce in 2007, known as the Pakistan Taliban. And this is relevant for ISIS, or Islamic State, in both countries for the following reasons. The militant groups that began targeting the Pakistani state under the banner of the Afghan Taliban were deeply sectarian in their orientation. They came from these militias like Sipe, Sabe, Pakistan, Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, and they were much more interested in killing Shias, killing Ahmadis, killing non-Muslim minorities. And so we had this situation develop, particularly after Osama bin Laden died and his charismatic grasp over al-Qaeda declined, and we had the announcement that Mullah Omar was in fact dead. This al-Qaeda, Afghan Taliban unity that still held sway over the Pakistan Taliban began to diminish, and we saw some of those Pakistan Taliban defecting to the Islamic State. And so now we have this situation where the Pakistanis are doing everything that they can to keep the Afghan Taliban alive in Pakistan. They are actively encouraging reorientation of their own Taliban towards any number of targets, trying to get them to go and support the Afghan Taliban, trying to get them to join groups like Jaish-e-Mohammed to go and kill the Indians, and even join the Islamic State in Afghanistan. So it is incredibly and increasingly difficult to disambiguate the different militant movements in these two countries. But what we really can say is that while there is much blame to go on the Afghan government for its corruption and so forth, you really cannot deal with what is a pretty robust finding in the scholarly literature that when insurgent groups have sanctuaries, as these insurgent groups do in Pakistan, it's nearly impossible to defeat them. So I have been, and you know, we've discussed this. Oh my goodness! I mean, I can't count the years that you and I have been discussing this on the show. We cannot bring any modicum of stability in Afghanistan as long as the Pakistanis want to destabilize the place. And we can scale up troops, we can scale down troops, we can change their mission, we can change the money that we're giving to the Afghans and how we give it. But what we haven't done is gotten together a real policy to deal with the Pakistan problem.
So let's move on. I mean, it's a lot of stuff I want to cover with you. Not to suggest that there's that the subject the subject matter is settled. There's obviously a lot.
No, more. No. But I mean, there's just a deluge of topics.
Exactly. I wanted to also cover the fact that Donald Trump's administration just announced their second travel ban, otherwise known as a Muslim ban, and already the state of Hawaii has challenged it. And now it's the state of Hawaii has been joined by Massachusetts, New York, and Washington State. Since you spend a lot of time in Muslim countries, what is their attitude about what's happening in terms of the first ban and now the second ban? And, of course, what's always been extraordinary about the first and the second ban is that the two countries that we've had the most problems with in terms of nurturing, training, exporting jihadis have been Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And they've been off the list.
And they're not on the list.
Right.
So the nonsensical nature of this Muslim ban, honestly, I think it boggles the minds of any sentient analyst. The countries on this list, they have not produced terrorists that have killed Americans on our soil in well over a quarter of a century. So it's absolutely flummoxing. How it is that they arrived at these countries. I mean, now, the interesting thing is that they will use the argument that because they don't include all Muslim countries, this is not a Muslim ban, but we all see through this because all of the countries on the list are, in fact, Muslim. So it is completely confusing as to how they can say that this is supposed to protect our security when, as you noted, the countries that are the biggest threat to our security are not on the list, and the countries that are on the list have posed virtually no threat to our security. And I think it also just needs to be said violently, and it needs to be repeated violently, that consistent sources of data show that the most significant threat to Americans is not Muslims. It is right-wing, racist, extremist groups, which this government refuses to even recognize as terrorist, even though they fit the definition of the Federal Bureau of Investigation as being terrorist organizations. Think about the white supremacist attack in Canada. No mention of them being terrorist, even though that the attacker certainly fit the definition of being a terrorist. And similarly, the white supremacist attacks that have happened on minorities since he's been inaugurated, it's just impossible to get this government to call them what they are, and that's terrorists. So, yeah, it's absolutely mind-boggling. It does, in my view, and I'm not a legal scholar, I suspect this is going to be one of the arguments made. It violates the Establishment Clause, right, which is that we cannot have laws that are discriminatory based upon religion in one way or another. So, like everyone else, I share the complete bafflement and flummoxing over what it is that they're trying to do. What we can say is that this ban is most certainly a Muslim ban. And we can say that no matter what they're trying to say in terms of couching this in terms of our security, this policy does not address our biggest source of insecurity, which is coming from domestic terrorists. And, you know, and similarly, I would say this aggressive roundup of so-called illegals who are allegedly violent criminals. The data don't support that they're all violent criminals, and they are disrupting families. And I think the other bizarre thing about this discourse, and of course Trump supporters are notoriously fact-resistant, they'll just label this as fact news, there are consistent sources of data, including from the Department of Justice itself, that says on average immigrants are far less likely to commit legal offenses than are natives. And the reason for that's pretty obvious, right? They're much more vulnerable than natives. So I think what we could say is that the things that this administration they're trying to do, they're certainly racist, they're motivated by bigotry, and they're trying to justify them in the name of increasing our security. But when you look at the facts on the ground, the facts don't really support that story in any way, shape, or form.
And Christine Fay, you just got back from India. How is that story playing of the Indian man who was shot and killed in a bar, and his friend was wounded, and then a Sikh...
Well, there have been three shootings
exactly.
in the last week and a half.
Right, and the Sikh fellow who was washing his car in the driveway and was...
Yeah.
So, what I mean, people have got to be wondering whether Donald Trump is somehow sending a signal or condoning, or is it this is just in the zeitgeist? How's it playing?
Well, unfortunately, it's not that straightforward. You know, I also was in India much over the summer, and I've been spending a lot of time in India. And it was, for me, a very frustrating time to be in India because you had there, as you have here, it's a minority for sure, but it's a very vocal, noxious minority that call themselves Hindus for Trump. Now, these Hindus for Trump will justify their position usually using the euphemistic expression that he will be tough on Muslims or he will be tough on Islamic terrorism. This is usually code speak to really mask their own deep antipathy towards Muslims, and they sort of recognize that Trump hates Muslims like they do. They have yet to be chastened, and I remember having very robust arguments with these Hindus for Trump. You know, now, oh my goodness, going over a year or more. And I explained to them, look, you know, the American bigot is an ignorant bigot. They're not going to be able to tell that some Indian sitting in a bar is not a Muslim, or as they would say, a Muslim. So you can't support a bigot thinking that his bigotry is only going to affect your enemy. In fact, there's going to be a lot of innocent people affected by this bigotry because your American can't distinguish. I mean, we've known time and time again that American bigots routinely confuse Indians. And of course, some Indians are Muslims. In fact, many Indians are Muslims. So I would say that the discourse in India is very mixed. The Hindu nationalists, who are, of course, in power right now with the BJP, they have been unchastened by this violence against Indians here in the United States. They continue to repeat the canard, and they're very much influenced by the same kind of nonsense as Americans are, this Breitbart story that Hillary Clinton is in bed with the Saudis. They repeat these preposterous conspiracy theories about Huma Abedin. So you'll recognize a lot of their noxious narrative to be what is said here about Hillary Clinton, when in fact the facts are just the opposite. I mean, what we've seen is that Trump himself is just as compromised by the Saudis. He has much more extensive business holdings in Saudi Arabia than the Clinton Foundation ever did. So I would say in India there's a lot of confusion. On the one hand, they want to believe that Trump is going to be more vigorous in clamping down against Muslims and Islamic terrorism. But you also have, I would say, the majority of Indians who recognize him for what he is and are very fearful. And, of course, the H-1B visa issue is another one that comes up, because even if you don't, even for those Hindus for Trump who support him because of his anti-Muslim agenda, at some point they're going to have to come to the economic reality that Trump wants to kick Indians out of this country as a part of his, let's make America white again campaign. Right. So there's not a single reading of this in my engagements with Indians going back now really maybe over a year, when it was really apparent that he was going to be the presidential candidate for the Republicans, and then obviously became president.
And again, another subject I wanted to cover here is that in this ban, at least the initial ban, of course, it said, and this went under the radar, the executive order read, the United States should not admit those who engage in acts of bigotry or hatred, including honor killings and other forms of violence against women. Now we know, of course, that the people who drafted this, Steve Bannon, chief strategist, along with Donald Trump, have been accused of committing violence against women. Donald Trump had eight women came forward to accuse accuse him of sexual assault, along with his ex-wife Ivana. And Stephen Bannon, of course, was charged with domestic violence and battery in 1996 in Santa Monica. So at the same time as doing this Islamophobic stuff in terms of the Muslim ban, the administration is apparently drafting plans to cut $480 million out of the DOJ's budget in terms of grants to stop violence against women. But it's also worth noting that the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, in 2013 voted against the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. So you got 1,500 women a year murdered by their husbands, either beaten to death or shot or whatever, in this country. And here they are scapegoating Muslims on the basis of honor killings.
Well, see, look, you just nailed it beautifully. And this is what I love about you. You just don't mince your words on that. So there's really nothing else to say. I mean, other than to look at the other crude misogynist things that this administration has done, right? It has targeted withdrawing financial as well as political support from UN regimes that support women's and children's rights. Look at the health care fiasco that it's currently trying to pass. It does everything it can to deprive not only American women, but for that matter, women across the world of agency in controlling our fecundity. We obviously were crudely amused when the president, as I can't call him, President Trump, said that he respected women yesterday. And, of course, the Twitter sphere responded in kind by reminding him of all of the grotesque things that he said about women, that you have to be mean to them, that if his dinner's not on the table when he gets home, he gets really angry, that you have to treat them like obviously, the notorious pussy grabbing, his, quote, moving in on her like a bitch. I don't even know what that means, to be honest. I have many dogs. I have no idea what he meant by that. So when we look at the complete misogyny of this administration, not only the president and his cabinet, but for that matter, these misogynist swine sitting in both the House and the Senate, Ryan, Mitch McConnell, the list just goes on and on, to see them justify their bigotry against Muslims on the backs of some kind of feigned concern for women is truly outrageous. But I will say that I see this a lot. I find that American Christians will say that their problems with Islam is that or that they don't treat women well, and then they'll go on to adumbrate those concerns. But when you point out that the Christian Bible is also pretty horrible, that their own faith do not admit equality of women and so forth, it becomes really clear that they're not feminists, right? That they're simply using this as a cudgel with which they can beat Muslims. So you nailed it. I mean, this is a kind of hypocrisy that's truly gut-churning. And I think the other thing to state here is that women all across this country have been made physically ill by Donald Trump's abuse of women, his boasting about his abuse of women, his violent threats to shut them up. And the reason for this is that many women in this country have PTSD from sexual assault. If you were to talk to healthcare providers who deal with PTSD, healthcare providers all over the country have been grappling with the increased needs of their patients. And this is simply a fact. I have PTSD from sexual assault. When the conservatives say that we're crying and we're sad because we lost the election, that is a further insult. We're actually angry that a large percentage of this population chose to vote not only for a president, but for a bunch of individuals down ticket who not only have no regard for women, but who actually have disdain, who have supported violence against us. And those people that say, I voted for Trump in spite of his abuse of women because I felt like he has an economic agenda that's better for me, I want to tell those people that you are moral cowards. You are pusillanimous poltroons. They are the moral equivalent of Germans who supported Hitler because the trains would run on time. There's never an excuse to support a sexual predator that we have in the White House. There simply is never a reason good enough.
Well, in the last minute, Chris Fair, the fact that the day after he was inaugurated, millions of women took to the street, and they did so yesterday as well. Yeah. Isn't there something happening, some pushback going on?
So people, as we saw with the Occupy movement, simply protesting on the streets does not translate to a political agenda. And the simple fact remains that individuals in the flyover states that don't want to live in those, you know, moral morasses are migrating to cities because of the slave state college, which some people will call the electoral college, but I choose not to. It underweights the votes of the cosmopolitan progressive cities, and it overempowers the unprogressive individuals in the former slave states. Literally, it does this. So the structure of the slave state college will make it very, very difficult for a democratic progressive future because it's the math of it. And, of course, the idea of a Republican Party effort to get rid of the electoral college, or as I call it, slave state college, is absolutely nil, since that's their best mechanism to retain their claim to the White House. We also have GOP-sponsored efforts all over the country to deprive minorities and other people that are likely to vote Democratic of their right to vote through these noxious either voter registration or actual voter ID laws, which are little more than efforts to deprive the people of their right to vote. And on top of it, we have gerrymandering. So there are a lot of structural barriers that will make it very difficult to simply translate the street action and the anger that we're seeing into political outcomes that are going to matter. So I'm not optimistic that these marches, and I've been a vocal participant of them myself, are actually going to result in political change, because the GOP, or as I call it, the Grab Our Pussy Party, really doesn't care about women. And it seems pretty confident right now that it doesn't even need women to execute its broad suite of policies that are deeply misogynist. And I don't think they're wrong. I don't think that given the structural situation I just described to you, that we're going to be in a position to make our voices heard and to make our opposition to these obnoxious policies relevant in a way that's going to hurt the Grab Our Pussy Party going forward. And that's what I call them. When they rally around a sexual predator at the expense of all principles, what else can they be called but the Grab Our Pussy Party?
Well, Christine Fair, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure talking to you. You just seem to nail this stuff, and you just have the right way of summarizing it so well.
Well, thank you, Christine. And again, I've been talking with Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program, who specializes in South Asian security issues. She's a member of Women in International Security and the American Institute for Pakistan Studies. And her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me. Scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.